This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Healthcare reform is one of the top issues for voters in the presidential race, but it's a little confusing trying to figure out the differences in the candidates' plans. Here to help sort that out is Jonathan Oberlander, who's joined us several times before to explain healthcare policy issues. He's an associate professor of social medicine and health policy and administration at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. He's also the author of the book, The Political Life of Medicare. He's written about presidential politics and healthcare reform for the New England Journal of Medicine. Jonathan Oberlander, welcome back to Fresh Air. Since healthcare has been playing a big role in the Obama and Clinton campaigns, let's start there. You've described the Obama and Clinton plans as remarkably similar. What are some of the things they have in common?
Both of them really build on the mixed system of public and private insurance that we already have in the United States. They both rely on a modified employer mandate, what we like to call player pay, where employers either have to provide coverage to their workers or they have to pay a tax to the government that would pay for the costs of their workers to get medical care. They also rely on the establishment of purchasing pools where people could buy private insurance, and that insurance would be much more heavily regulated than it is now. And finally, and what I think is really an interesting part of their plans, they each would create a new public plan similar to Medicare, and people could choose if they want to keep their private insurance, if they want to join one of the new private insurance options, or if they want to join the public plan.
And do we have any sense of what those public plans would look like?
They have been fairly vague about that, as candidates often are in this election season, other than to say it would be like Medicare.
So you've mentioned some of the similarities between the Obama and Clinton healthcare plans. What are some of the differences?
Well, really, there's only one substantial difference, and that has to do with this issue of individual mandates, which has gotten a lot of attention recently. In Hillary Clinton's plan, she would mandate that all Americans have to have health insurance. So in other words, there would be a requirement that you would have to have insurance. In the Obama plan, he mandates only that children have to have insurance. And that's really what they've been fighting about for the past few months.
Now, what's the logic of having a mandate in the first place?
Well, there's both a substantive and political logic. The substantive logic is that if you make health insurance voluntary, what you may get is disproportionately sick people taking up the subsidies and joining private insurance. And if that happens, it's really hard to make the pooling of risk work. You get something that economists call adverse selection. That is a risk pool that is sicker than an average population, and that can be unstable over time. There's also an argument that everybody should have to contribute their fair share and therefore pay premiums. If you get in an accident and you're uninsured in a future healthcare system, we're still going to treat you at the emergency room. And the rest of us who are already paying our premiums are going to pick up your costs. And so the question is, who should pay for that care? If you force everybody to contribute premiums, you spread medical care costs across a broad population. There's also a political argument for doing this, and that is that you tap into a rhetoric of responsibility. Generally, when people have talked about healthcare reform, it's been about entitlements, creating a new program, liberal ideas about rights. When you talk about an individual mandate, it really taps into notions of responsibility and what everybody has to do, not just the government.
Well, the downside of the mandate is that some people see it as punitive. If you don't elect to buy insurance, there might be a consequence that you face. So what are the consequences that Obama has come up with for his children's program and that Hillary Clinton has come up with for everybody?
Neither one has really spelled out, as far as I know, what the penalties would be. And you're right, a mandate is only as good as the penalties behind it. I could mandate that all my students come to class, and maybe some of them would come to class out of civic duty. But unless I had penalties in there, I guarantee you that a few of them aren't going to be there. So it really depends on, you know, what the financial penalties and the incentives are, and we don't know that yet. What the Obama people argue is it's unfair to have a mandate until you make health insurance affordable. Because if you do it and health insurance costs people more than they can afford to spend, that you're essentially punishing them for not having health insurance, and that's not right. That's the substantive case against a mandate. The political case is exactly what you said, that you make health reform punitive, that you make it all about penalties, all about garnishing people's wages, all about taxes. And that's not really a good way to get health reform passed.
So how is Hillary Clinton trying to counter Barack Obama's charges that her policy is punitive?
What she's saying is that this is the only way to get universal coverage. And if you do not have a mandate, if you do not require people to join insurance pools. And, you know, most people who are uninsured want insurance. So we're talking, I think, about a minority of the uninsured population. But if you don't require that minority to join up, we cannot have universality. We cannot control costs. We cannot do the things in quality that we want to do.
Does history have anything to say about whether people who are well are willing to pay for health insurance if they really don't think that they're going to get sick? Because this gets back to the risk pool that you were talking about.
There's sort of a mixed record here, but we know one place to look is the non-group market in insurance. That's where individuals who don't have employer-sponsored insurance go out and try and buy insurance. And we know from the way that insurance companies act that they're very worried in a voluntary situation that sick people are disproportionately going to purchase health insurance. And we know that part of the uninsured population are young people who are relatively healthy. You know, they haven't passed the age of 30, and so their warranty has not expired yet. And some of them, you know, feel that they're not making a lot of money and they don't want to spend the money they have on health insurance. And so they have disproportionately high rates of uninsurance. And it's exactly that population that you do want to bring into an insurance pool.
Now, both Clinton and Obama's health insurance plan call for employers to fund a major part of it. And this is happening at a time when a lot of people think we should change the employer-based healthcare system, since so many people are either unemployed or they're freelancers who don't have a genuine employer who's going to pay for benefits. So is this an unusual time to be cementing in the employer-based healthcare system?
It is sort of in Congress, I suppose. In healthcare reform, I think the very first decision you have to make is whether you want to build on employer-sponsored insurance or away from it. There are a lot of good reasons to build away from it. It's an expensive system. It's an inefficient system. It's inequitable. And as you pointed out, it's also a system that's eroding, frankly. On the other hand, 160 million Americans under the age of 65 still get their health insurance through their employers. And I believe employers paid about $450 billion in insurance premiums last year. What that means concretely, if you want to try and move away from employer-sponsored insurance, you have to affect health insurance for 160 million people, many of whom, by the way, like the insurance they have, believe that even if the system is a wreck, they're doing pretty well. And it also means you have to replace employer financing. You're going to have to substitute taxes for those $500 billion that they're spending. And there aren't too many candidates who want to do that. And it's ironic in a sense because really we've had the same debate since 1970. And in the early 70s, Richard Nixon proposed universal health insurance around an employer mandate. And the debate over universal coverage comes down to many things, but really what it has come down to in the last 35 years, are we willing to adopt an employer mandate? And so far the answer has been no.
What do the Democratic candidates have to say about the responsibility of employers to pay? And what about like small businesses who often say they have trouble paying that much in terms of health insurance?
What they say for larger businesses is that either you have to provide coverage to your workers or you have to pay a payroll tax to the government to fund medical care for them. For smaller businesses, they would be exempt from the employer mandate. I believe that Hillary Clinton has said businesses with under 25 workers would be exempt from her mandate. She would also provide a tax credit as a subsidy to encourage them to provide insurance. I'm not sure that the Obama campaign has released the exact number of workers where they would exempt the mandate, but they have a similar philosophy. And that has a political rationale. You want to buy off small business because they've played a role in killing healthcare reform in the past, and it's also very difficult for them to afford it. The problem you get into is that the uninsured are disproportionately concentrated in small businesses. So if you exempt small businesses from the employer mandate, that's millions of more workers that you're going to have to pick up and pay for through some other mechanism.
So where is the federal funding for the Obama and Clinton health care plans coming from?
Most of the funding in their plans comes from canceling the 2001 and 2003 Bush tax cuts for families making over $250,000. And there's a lot of money to be had there. You can get an estimated $50 to $60 billion a year from canceling those tax cuts. But there is, in a sense, less here than meets the eye, because it's true that they could use that money. And we're going to have, I think, one of the most important debates in the campaign is over the future of the tax cuts and future of tax policy in this country. And they certainly are right in arguing that if we extend those tax cuts, that's money that we could have used on health care reform. On the other hand, that money is not going to help them in the budget. We have what are called PAYGO rules, which means pay as you go. You can't enact a new entitlement program that worsens the federal deficit. Instead, you either have to have taxes that pay for all of it, or you have to have savings from another program to offset the costs. And the problem is the Congressional Budget Office, in their estimates, already assumes that all the tax cuts, not just the ones for people making over $250,000, are going to be canceled. So in terms of trying to finance this in a way that's going to satisfy the Congressional Budget Office, which is really what it comes down to, so you don't worsen the deficit, you actually can't count on 1 cent from those canceling those tax cuts. And what that means, if either Obama or Clinton come to office in January in 2009, one of their first jobs is going to be how to find the money to pay for this.
Which won't be easy considering the deficit that we have.
No, it's going to be politically difficult. To add the uninsured to the existing system costs probably in the neighborhood of $100 billion, and that's a lot of money. On the other hand, we already spend $2 trillion in the healthcare system, so this is a marginal increase. And it's also worth pointing out that we tend to find money for priorities. When we went to Afghanistan or we went to Iraq, we found the money to pay for that. When we did the tax cuts in 2001 and 2003, we didn't worry about the deficit. When we enacted Medicare Part D to give seniors prescription drugs, we didn't worry about where the money came from. And I think the problem that the uninsured have is not that there's not enough money, it's that they're not a high enough political priority in the system to compel that money.
Anything else you want to mention about the Obama or the Clinton health insurance plan?
Well, I think one thing that's interesting is what they do about cost control. And the paradox here is what really puts healthcare reform on the agenda in the United States is rising costs. But the more that a proposal controls costs, the more difficult it is to actually get it passed. And so what you see is candidates in both parties really, in a way, pretending that they're going to control costs without having very robust limits on healthcare spending. And so both Senator Obama and Senator Clinton have talked about savings from prevention, using electronic medical records and information technology, chronic care and disease management, and all these things I think are worth doing. None of them is going to control costs. And the hope is that maybe if you do enough of the small things together, maybe you end up controlling costs in the long run. I'm not sure that's right. I think you can make the case that once you enact a program like this, a big public program, and once you start spending on it, the government gets an incentive to control costs. That's essentially what happened with Medicare in 1965 when it was enacted. It had no cost control either, and then eventually we got the political will to impose that. But it is striking that these proposals don't really have tight cost controls.
You said that the big difference between the Obama and the Clinton health insurance plans is the mandatory requirements for each, that Obama just has a mandatory requirement that children be insured. Clinton has a mandatory requirement that everybody be insured. And then there's the question, is that necessary? Is that punitive? John Edwards, who's no longer in the race, he had a different approach to this. He was going to require that individuals show proof of health insurance when they filed their income taxes. And if they didn't have insurance, instead of being penalized, they'd be automatically enrolled in an insurance plan. Did that part of his insurance plan get a reaction?
Well, I think, first of all, you have to credit him because he was the first candidate out of the box with a universal plan. And I think on the Democratic side, he really set a kind of high bar that the other candidates had to either jump to or at least get close. And, you know, ever since the Edwards plan, they've been busy trying to out-universalize each other. automatic enrollment is something that the other campaigns have talked about, particularly the Obama campaign, in lieu of an individual mandate. But Edwards also talked about, at the end of his campaign, potentially garnishing people's wages. And it probably tells you everything you need to know about the politics of this issue, that the one candidate that talked honestly about ways to enforce an individual mandate is no longer in the race.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about the different presidential candidates' health care plans. And here to describe them and analyze them is Jonathan Oberlander. He's an associate professor of social medicine and health policy and administration at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. And he's written extensively about health policy over the years. Well, let's look at the Republicans. John McCain is the presumptive Republican presidential nominee. He promises to make health insurance affordable and available. What does he mean by that?
He has really emphasized cost control. If you go to his website and you look at his plan, or if you hear him talk, that's really how he comes at the healthcare issue. And the core of his plan in terms of improving access is establishment of a new tax credit. Any American who purchased private health insurance would get a refundable tax credit of $2,500 or $5,000 for a family.
And is health insurance mandatory? Is there a national health insurance that would be offered to people who couldn't afford private insurance?
What is really striking about the McCain plan, and really the other Republican candidates' plans, is what they don't have in them. In contrast to the Democrats, there is no employer mandate. There is no individual mandate. There is no regulation, enhanced regulation of the insurance industry. Quite the opposite. He actually wants to deregulate the insurance industry so people can shop across state lines and purchase insurance.
And does he believe that that will lead to competition, which will keep costs down? Is that the rationale?
Exactly. What I think his campaign would say is that the system we have right now is not really a good test of competition, and we need to put those incentives in place that unleash competitive forces, and that will help restrain healthcare spending.
So for the uninsured, what McCain is offering is tax breaks?
Yes. And, you know, I think most health policy analysts would tell you that through that kind of tax credit system, you're not going to cover most of the uninsured. Health insurance is too expensive. And what you're trying to do, and it's interesting in the McCain plan, the Democrats are building on the status quo of employer-sponsored insurance. What Senator McCain is trying to do is move away from employer-sponsored insurance and get people to buy insurance in the non-group or individual market. The problem with that is the non-group or individual market is sort of a state of nature. It's very expensive. It's very inefficient. There's medical underwriting, so sick people often have to pay more for coverage. So it's not clear that just by giving people a tax credit, you're really going to get enough of the uninsured.
Well, and when you're poor and you're not really paying much in taxes because you're not making enough money to pay a lot of taxes, what does the tax credit do for you?
Well, he has made the tax credit, I believe, refundable. And a refundable tax credit is open to anyone, even if you don't pay taxes. You can still get the money. So that is a good part of the plan and a dramatic improvement, I think, over some of the other proposals that we've seen in the last couple of years. But really the question is, what happens to low-income folks? Are there going to be subsidies that allow them, on top of these credits, to purchase insurance? And we don't know a lot of the details of his plan yet, so we haven't heard much about that.
What about Mike Huckabee? What's his health insurance plan?
Mike Huckabee is an interesting case because he has his own powerful personal story of losing a lot of weight and exercising. And, you know, you always see him out running on the campaign trail. And so when he talks about health reform, he talks a lot about prevention, about exercise. He talks a lot about taking on the obesity problem in the United States. His general plan is short on details at this point, but it's in line with the McCain plan. It would also be a tax deduction. He has proposed, in addition, a tax credit for low-income individuals like John McCain. He's talked about reforming the medical malpractice system. But I think maybe the most important point about his plan is, like the McCain plan, it seeks to move people away from employer-sponsored insurance and to really beef up the non-group insurance market.
Thank you. Mitt Romney dropped out of the campaign last week. Now, he was governor when he signed a proposal for a state health care plan in Massachusetts. Did his national health care plan reflect the successes or failures of the Massachusetts experience?
I think his national plan reflected the opportunities and constraints of running for president in a Republican primary. You know, the Massachusetts plan is similar in many respects to the Obama plan and the Clinton plan, although, as I said before, they've added this public plan option on top of that. But the purchasing pool, the individual mandate, subsidized access to insurance, all of that is in the Massachusetts plan. All of that is in the Democrats' plans. He was, when he was running for president, not committed to his own plan from Massachusetts, but instead preached about states' rights and using federalism and really having states try different approaches. And what he argued was, you know, what's right for Massachusetts may not work, say, for North Carolina. But I think politically, what was crucial is that running for president in the Republican primary on the Massachusetts plan was just a non-starter.
Has the Massachusetts plan been working out?
The Massachusetts plan has been getting killed, I think, recently in the national media. It's taken a lot of bad press. I'm of the opinion that it's gotten a raw deal. I think the Massachusetts plan is not perfect. It's not universal. It's got a lot of problems. You can argue about whether some of the insurance policies are really adequate. It certainly is short on financing, and one of the major problems it faces going forward is how are they going to finance this? But they have covered 300,000 people since the plan started, and I think that's a tremendous accomplishment, and I think it's the best that we can expect a state to do in this country is what Massachusetts has done. And so although it has lots of problems, I would give it a pretty good score so far.
What are the pluses and minuses of having state health care systems as opposed to a federal health insurance system?
States have acted where the federal government has not. So at the moment, the choice has not been between a state-based system and a federal system. The choice is having states move on their own or having the federal government do nothing. Now, you can have a state-based universal system, and some people have proposed this, where we say the federal government says everybody has to be covered, but we're going to let states decide how to do it. And one of the advantages in having states experiment is they can try different ideas that fit the political circumstances of their state. So what works in Massachusetts and what the people of Massachusetts want is going to be very different than what the people of North Carolina want. So that's the argument for it, and really the argument for federalism as laboratories of democracy. The argument against it is no state has been able to attain universal coverage. They just don't have the money to do it. And even the Massachusetts plan is highly dependent on revenues that they're getting from the federal government. And if you depend on states, you're really going to institutionalize an inequitable system because some states are much richer than other states and they have much more ability to cover people. And I think if we're going to solve the uninsured problem and we're going to solve the cost problem, it has to be a national solution, although states have been playing an important role. One thing that is evident in Massachusetts and other state plans, they have a very difficult time controlling costs. In fact, the way that they get these expansions for the uninsured past in their states is not to control costs, because to control costs is to take on the insurance industry and doctors and hospitals and drug companies. And so they don't control costs. And that's great in the short term to get the expansion passed. The problem comes in the long term when you have to pay the bill.
Employers, I think, if given the chance, would love to get out of the health insurance business because the health insurance costs have been rising so much and employers have been picking up a lot of the tab for that. So if there's any loopholes in the plan where employers can get out of paying, I think they would try to do that. Is it possible that with an alternative plan that relies on employers, that employers would find a kind of way out of it?
My view has always been that if universal coverage comes in this country, it may actually come from the right and not the left, in the sense that business may be the industry that brings it to us. Now, the situation for businesses is really, you know, they have to make a calculation. Do we want to keep on trying to maintain private insurance, or do we want to get out and support some kind of government system, maybe a player pay mandate where the tax to get out isn't very expensive, so we're going to do better in the long run? And you have seen some prominent business people. I'm thinking of Steve Bird, who's the CEO of Safeway out in California, and he supported the reforms that Governor Schwarzenegger had proposed out there and is a very strong advocate of universal coverage. Even Walmart, which has taken a lot of criticism over the years for its own health insurance, has joined a coalition with labor unions in favor of universal coverage. If business comes to the side of healthcare reform, if business comes to the side of universal coverage, that gives reformers a way to balance the opposition that is inevitable from the insurance industry and other stakeholders in the healthcare system. It really is a realignment in healthcare politics. I'm not sure we're there yet. And of course, I can't say anything optimistic without finding the gray cloud. And the gray cloud to this silver lining is that the Clinton administration thought exactly the same thing in 1993 and 1994. And what happened to them in part is they overlooked small business. And small business is ideologically opposed to employer mandates, and they worked very hard to defeat the Clinton plan. Now, maybe with these new plans that are exempting small business, and small businesses are having a terrible time with healthcare costs at the moment, maybe they can sideline them. But I don't think we're quite at the point where we can say this is going to happen.
On the whole, is the primary campaign making you optimistic that there will be some meaningful and fundamental healthcare reform in the near future?
There are two groups of health policy analysts, pessimists and deep pessimists, and I'm in the second group. So the short answer to your question is no. I mean, when I look at this, I've seen so much failure already. Is, you know, I have a case really of deja vu to the early 1990s, and I don't see yet any reason why this is going to turn out differently. But it really depends on the elections. You know, if we were to talk again in January 2009 and we see who the president is and we see what the majorities in Congress are, then we'll understand what the chances are for a healthcare reform. I am more hopeful than at any point I've been in the past 15 years because it's on the agenda, because there's a lot of momentum for this. And maybe we have failed so much that people are finally ready to come to the grips with the fact that we need to do something. And I think one point that reformers have really failed to make enough is that the choice is not between the status quo and a reformed healthcare system. Because if we do not act, the status quo is not going to stay where it is in American healthcare. It's going to get much worse, and millions more Americans are going to lose their health insurance. Costs are going to go through the roof. More businesses are going to have difficulty. So we have to understand that if we do not act to fix this problem now, it's not going to get better on its own. We found that out in the last decade. It's going to get a lot worse.
Jonathan Oberlander, good to talk with you again. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me on.
Jonathan Oberlander is an associate professor of social medicine and health policy and administration at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. This is Fresh Air.
Enter Hamlet.
To be or not to be, that is the question. Whether 'tis nobler in the mind to suffer the stings and arrows. Sorry. The slings and arrows. Whether 'tis nobler in the mind to suffer the slings and end. The slings and arrows of outrageous fortune. Or to take arms against a sea of troubles and by opposing end them.
Ouch. That's a Hollywood heartthrob rehearsing Hamlet in a scene from the TV series Slings and Arrows, set backstage and onstage at a dysfunctional Canadian theater company that produces an annual Shakespeare festival. Slings and Arrows originated in Canada, has been shown on the Sundance Channel, and just came out on DVD. My guest Mark McKinney co-created and co-wrote the series and plays the role of the company's chief administrator, Richard Smith Jones. Richard has to deal with two temperamental directors. One is troubled but brilliant. The other is a pretentious egomaniac. Mark McKinney was a cast member of the Canadian sketch comedy series The Kids in the Hall and went from there to Saturday Night Live. Here's another scene from Slings and Arrows. Richard and one of the company's funders have just come out of seeing a production of the ABBA musical Mamma Mia. The funder is played by Jennifer Irwin.
And the dancing and the singing. I understood every word.
I know. I swear to God, it gets better every time.
Thank you. Just goes to show you gotta keep things in perspective, you know? You know, I saw Chorus Line when I was 16 on Broadway. I was blown away. You know? I cried. cry.
I love that show.
It's what made me want to go into theater. I used to listen to all those albums, you know, Damn Yankees, Kiss Me, Kate. My parents thought I was gay. How the hell did I wind up in New Bourbon? How did that happen?
Okay, do not torture yourself. Come on, let's go for a drink.
You know what they are? They're pure entertainment.
That's right.
I'm so sick of hearing it's a dense play. Oh, it's a difficult play. I've never seen anyone come dancing and singing out of the Swan like we just did.
I know, and why do you think that is?
Well, because Shakespeare. Shakespeare's like
400 years old.
And I don't even think it was that good.
There, I said it.
I mean, you know, it's entertaining people. I mean, I'm not saying that, like, ABBA were better writers.
No, I know what you mean.
I don't like Shakespeare.
Nobody does, Richard. That's the thing. You put on plays that nobody wants to see. God, what a waste.
You're right.
That's Mark McKinney in a scene from the first season of Slings and Arrows. Mark McKinney, welcome to Fresh Air. One of the things I love about Slings and Arrows is it gets to some of the things that are most wonderful about good theater and most cringe-inducing about bad theater. So I thought we'd start with some of the cringe-inducing stuff. Don McKellar, who's a really good Canadian actor, and I think director, too. Does he direct?
Director and writer, yeah.
Yeah, so he plays a very pretentious director who's originally brought in to direct, to take over a production of Hamlet. And this is a director so pretentious and so wanting to put his like own touch on everything, his own creative touch, that he did a version of The Tempest set in Nazi Germany. So let's hear a scene from episode 3 of the first season of Slings and Arrows. And this is how this very pretentious director introduces himself to the cast of Hamlet when he takes over the production.
Hello, everyone. I am Darren Nichols. Deal with that. All right. Re-Hamlet. Hamlet. This play is dead. It has been dead for over 300 years. It has been strip-mined for quotations and propped up like Lenin in his ice cave. I don't worship dead texts, but that doesn't mean I don't find interest in them. Now, as to my vision, I'm taking the word rotten, as in something's rotten in the state of Denmark, very seriously. I want a rank and foul-looking, foul-acted, and if possible, foul-smelling Hamlet. A decomposed vessel somewhere between the swamp and the sewer. Anyway, that's the general idea. Questions? Okay. Let's read this corpse.
That's so great. That's Don McKellar in a scene from Slings and Arrows, playing a very pretentious director. And my guest, Mark McKinney, is one of the writers of the series and one of the stars. This character must have been so much fun to write. I'm sure you've met directors kind of like this.
Yeah, it's loosely based on a long series of discussions we had about a couple of, those... angry martinet megalomaniac. Okay, help me out here. Megalomaniacal, is that it?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, we've all known a few, and so we sort of embodied it in the character of Darren Nichols. And I got to say that it's almost my favorite line in the series. My name is Darren Nichols. Deal with that. It's a perfect introductory line. I wish I could claim credit for it. I think it's Bob.
So, what are some of the awful traits you gave this director?
Well, he's completely self-obsessed, and he's the second son, and Jeffrey, played by Paul Gross, is clearly the gifted one, and I think he goes around with just this hanging resentment, this bitterness that he knows he can't, dare to get it right, so he just derides and mocks, and that's where his creativity comes from, is putting down the very thing that he should be embracing.
In the final season of Slings and Arrows, there's a production of Lear that the Shakespeare Festival is doing, and the actor playing Lear is a leading Shakespearean actor who is secretly dying of cancer. And when this production happens at the end, it's after they've totally run out of money, they're only going to do it once. And so this performance that they actually do give is incredibly moving. And the actor who plays the actor playing Lear is really great. Tell us a little bit about that actor and the circumstances surrounding this performance.
Well, William Hutt, who played the character Charles Kingman, who's the dying actor, who's the heroin addict, and who plays the Lear in the third series, had actually given a legendary Lear at the Stratford Festival a couple of years before the series. And for some reason, this had never been taped. And so this is the archive of at least pieces of that great performance. And we're lucky to get it, as he actually died last year.
So the actor who played the actor playing Lear died not long after making the show.
No, he died, in the fall.
I'd like to play just a clip from that performance of Lear, the play within the series.
Oh, you are made of stone! And are your tongues and eyes? I'd use them so that heaven's vault should crack. She's gone. Forever. I know when one is dead. And when one lives, she's dead as earth. Lend me a looking glass, that if her breath or mist will stain the stone within, she lives.
LX 57, go. And stand by for curtain call, everyone.
That's a scene from Slings and Arrows, and my guest, Mark McKinney, is one of the co-writers of the series and one of the stars, and he didn't write King Lear, however.
Well, bits of it.
Bits of it, yeah. In a series about really, you know, creative directors and actors, why did you cast yourself as the suit, the money guy, who kind of wants to be creative but maybe really isn't?
I don't know. Maybe because I sort of look at actors as something other than what I am. Do you know what I mean? I think I was kind of brought up to expect people to be reasonable. And I think artistic behavior, particularly tantrums, used to scare me when I first got into the business. And so I always had this part of myself that was wrestling with the reasonable versus the impulsive. And I see that conflict in Richard, like not sure what lane he should pick here.
So I take it you're not the kind of actor who brings the theater into real life. You know, like some people are so theatrical offstage as well as on, and they always seem to be in some kind of performance.
No, I think on the street you'd mistake me for a horticulturist.
What first got you excited about acting?
I think all the things that the characters in the place, I thought it was magic. I thought it was magical and daring and capable of achieving perfection. Does that make sense? Because mm-hmm. So few things in life really are, but it's something that you could do perfectly if you really, really worked at it.
My guest is Mark McKinney. His series Slings and Arrows just came out on DVD. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Mark McKinney. He's one of the writers and one of the stars of the series Slings and Arrows, which was produced for Canadian television, then was shown on Sundance, and now is out on DVD. A lot of people probably know you as one of the cast members of Kids in the Hall, the Canadian sketch comedy show that was shown in the United States, produced by Lorne Michaels, who also produces Saturday Night Live. Would you describe some of the characters that you originated for Kids in the Hall?
I guess the characters that people know is one of them was the head crusher, which was sort of a misanthropic, you know, foreign bag person who crushed people's heads between his thumb and forefinger.
He didn't really. He just would look at their heads through his thumb and forefinger and act as if he was.
Yes, exactly.
Right. Then there's the blues man that you did.
The blues man that I did, Mississippi Gary, which is sort of like a reflexive commentary on, you know, my last year of university where I was flunking English but learning how to play blues harmonica.
Oh. Yeah, tell us a story about that.
Well, I was at the University of Newfoundland and not doing well. And I had a friend named Roger House who was a quite good blues guitarist. And so we left university together at the same time and sort of made our way towards Calgary where all the jobs were. And on the way, he taught me how to play blues harmonica. But just at some point, I just thought, why am I taking this so seriously? I'm a you know, son of a diplomat from Ottawa, Canada. I don't really have any business playing the blues. So that's how Mississippi Gary was born. He knows that he's really not a blues person.
And how would you compare that show to Saturday Night Live?
Kids in the Hall?
Mm-hmm.
Well, Saturday Night Live's like an institution, and I guess it's a bigger, broader American comedy. And I don't mean like in any sense that it's less. It's just that Kids in the Hall were the five of us kind of working our own little, much more personal and idiosyncratic canvas, whereas Saturday Night Live kind of has a living newspaper, kind of an instant cultural commentary feel to it to me.
Did you ever do stand-up?
Oh, once or twice. I hated it.
Why?
Oh, it was too embarrassing. I always needed a group of people to sort of be among to face the terror of stage, I think.
Have you ever had an issue with stage fright?
Yes. Yeah, I did. I think I avoided it by performing without my glasses for the first 4 or 5 years, so I couldn't see the audience ever.
Well, you know, isn't it true that mostly on stage you can't see the audience because of the way the audience is dark and the stage is light, so you're looking at the stage lights and you really can't see who's in the audience?
I guess you can't. I often didn't, but I was lucky enough to be in a David Lindsay Abaire's second play, I think it was, Fuddy Mears at the Manhattan Theater Club. And one of the actors in the cast, the great Robert Stanton, used to come back always at halftime reporting in detail a face that he saw in the fourth row balcony and how they had been sneering at him or us. So I guess some people see it, some people don't. You sometimes vividly remember who's in the front row, though, days later.
You know, I don't act, but I've sometimes like spoken on stage, and if you can actually when the lights aren't dimmed and you can actually see who's in the audience, I find my eye goes directly to that one person who's sleeping, or I obsess on like the empty chairs and forget about the people
right.
who are actually there, and all you can think of is like, well, it's not completely filled. I see empty chairs in the back there, and it's really,
I know exactly what you mean.
It's really rattling. Yeah.
Show in San Francisco last about the four seats that were empty in the fifth row to the left.
And that's so unhealthy. it's like exactly what you should always be thinking about the people who've gone out of their way to come and hear you, not the people who didn't show up.
Yeah, no, but who were those four people, Terry? Who were they?
So
why didn't they come?
So how did you get your mind off of that distraction?
That's what I find performing on stage is like for me. It's a level. It's a meter of how much I'm into it. And if I'm at a good high level, I don't hear or see anything but the other person.
Now, one of the movies you were in was Spice World, the Spice Girls movie.
Do you want me to sign your DVD?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
You got everyone with me.
What was your part in it? I didn't see the movie. What was your part in it?
What? Well, why are we doing this interview? my part was George Wendt and I played sort of a producer-writer team, and he was my producer and I was his writer. And so we're trying to concoct the movie within the movie for the Spice Girls.
But you've written so many things that you've been in. You didn't participate in the writing in this, did you?
Of that, no.
Did you wish you had? I mean, do you sometimes end up performing in something where you feel like you could make it much better if you were rewriting it?
Not often. No, I've been really lucky. Unless I'm completely myopic, I haven't been in a lot of junk, and I'm lucky that way.
You're a writer and you're an actor. Do both of those jobs draw on different parts of who you are?
Yeah, completely. In fact, they affect your lifestyle. And on Kids in the Hall, it was very dramatic because we would go through cycles, 3, 4, 5 weeks of writing, then sort of a slow prep towards performing. And when I was writing, I would be up at 8 o'clock. My place was neat. My dishes were done. I wasn't living to excess. And then as we sort of folded and became actors, you know, the laundry would pile up and the nights would get later and the behavior more irresponsible until the whole thing would sort of roll through again. And I think it does trade off completely different sides of your personality.
Why would the actor part be more like sloppy or irresponsible?
Well, because I think you're tapping into sort of an impulsivity, and I think that there's more of a certain type of adrenaline released when you're performing that, you know, makes you stick around for an extra beer or, you know, watch 3 hours of CNN before you go to bed.
Well, Mark McKinney, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you so much for having me on your show.
Mark McKinney co-wrote and co-starred in the Canadian TV series Slings and Arrows, which just came out on DVD. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. I'm Terry Gross.